Why is Trump yanking TPS from Venezuelans? Why might black neighborhoods in Miami-Dade become a city? And why did we get rid of Haiti's most precious pig? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at President Trump's shocking decision to revoke temporary protected status for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans here who now face deportation back to a brutal dictatorship. We'll also look at a Miami-Dade effort just underway that could turn traditionally black communities into a new city. And we'll talk with the filmmaker behind a new WLRN-produced documentary that traces much of Haiti's crisis to the demise of the Creole pig. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Blindsided is how most Venezuelan expats say they feel about the Trump administration's decision this week to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan migrants in the U.S., most of them here in South Florida. TPS temporarily shields migrants from deportation back to crisis and disaster-torn countries like Venezuela, and it can be renewed every 18 months. But President Trump has decided not to extend it for more than 300,000 Venezuelans. That leaves another 200,000 to 300,000 Venezuelans who fear their TPS will be revoked as well, meaning they too would face deportation back to a brutal left-wing dictatorship in Venezuela, not to mention the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history. Last Friday, in fact, Trump sent an envoy to Caracas and got Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro to agree to accept the Venezuelans he plans to deport. And this is happening to a community that largely supported Trump in the November election. So how do we explain what the Venezuelan community is suddenly facing? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from both sides of the political spectrum to explore that question are two Venezuelan expat leaders here, Adelis Ferro, a Democrat in Weston who heads the nonprofit Venezuelan American Caucus, and Gustavo Garagori, a Republican in Doral who heads the Venezuelan American Republican Club of Miami-Dade. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you so much for inviting us, Tim.
Gustavo Garagori, I'd like to start with you because this week, Miami senior Republican Congressman Representative Mario Diaz-Balart, a strong supporter of Republican President Trump, wrote a letter to Homeland Security urging them not to deport Venezuelans who lose temporary protected status if they don't have a criminal record. So in essence, Diaz-Balart is telling the Trump administration, do not deport the vast majority of these Venezuelans you're taking TPS away from. As someone who supported President Trump in the last election, Gustavo, do you agree with Congressman Diaz-Balart that all non-criminal Venezuelan TPS recipients should still be protected from deportation, even if they lose their TPS? Do we have Gustavo on the line? Hi, Gustavo, are you there? Okay, well, we'll work to get Gustavo back with us. Adelis Ferro, let me put that question to you. Do you agree that that's what essentially Congressman Diaz-Balart is telling the Trump administration? Do not deport these people, just even if you have taken away their TPS.
This is that's the bare minimum he should do. We are his constituents, their constituents in South Florida. The biggest Venezuelan community is in South Florida, right. I mean, the biggest in the United States. So I think after a very weak joint statement that Congressman Diaz-Balart and Congressman Jimenez and Congresswoman Salazar published a few days ago, after all the community pressure, then finally they are calling, they are right. asking President Trump and asking for an action, and specifically asking to support Venezuelans
Now,
have to stay here.
either as a Democrat, I can understand why you would call that letter weak. But to be fair, to their credit, they are standing up in a rather unusual fashion to a president that is very popular with the Republican base. Were you surprised that they came out with that letter, sort of objecting, in essence, to the Trump decision to cut off TPS for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans? Did you find that unusual and, if not, even impressive?
I think it is unusual. You are totally right. And I think it's the result of the community pressure. And I think it's the demonstration that if when the community raise their voices, our voices, they hear us.
Okay.
And I think that's the lesson we have to take from that. So yes, they did what they have to do. Díaz-Balart, I believe he's doing what he has to do as our
As
representative.
the representative
So
of that
yeah,
community here, right? I think we do
exactly.
have Gustavo Garagori back with us. Gustavo, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Are you there now?
Hey, hello, how are you? Thank you for your invitation to your
No,
program.
thanks for
I
coming on.
appreciate
Gustavo, let me then repeat that same
it.
question to you. You heard how I was presenting there the fact that Congressman Diaz-Balart is telling the Trump administration, please do not deport the vast majority of the Venezuelans you've just taken TPS away from. Do you agree with Congressman Diaz-Balart, Gustavo, that all non-criminal Venezuelan TPS recipients should still be protected from deportation, even if they've lost their TPS?
So, well, I agree with Congress Mario Diaz-Balart. He's, and a super, super Congress from Venezuelan community. But I understand right now the big concern that we have in our community. So I understand it's not easy. So that situation is very hard. The people is getting panic and nervous, but so from my point of view, we have something interesting in this moment. At least we are record in database of the Homeland Security. So a difference others community, example, Guatemaltecan,
Right.
Honduras, Argentina, or whatever other,
Sure.
Italian or whatever. So we are there. So I think so that we have a very good way to looking for a solution for us.
Right.
So I support actually the act of dignity that the Congress María Elvira Salazar have in Congress right now.
Right.
So,
Gustavo,
yes.
as a Republican who supports Trump, though, what was your reaction to his decision to end TPS renewal for those more than 300,000 Venezuelans here who came to the U.S. in 2023? He canceled the extension that former President Biden provided for them just before he left office last month.
Well,
Why do you think President Trump did this?
so from the beginning, I understand that the President Trump is president of the United States, but not president of Venezuela,
Sure.
of the Republic of Venezuela. Okay? And his most important promise in campaign was American first. I understand that thing.
Sure.
From this point in forward, so I understand all the resolution that a president did. I understand that again the big concern that we face in our community, but I understand too that this administration took that decision. But I think so that we're looking for and assumes a solution at these things
Sure.
for that I say you in the beginning. So we are in records. The Venezuelan, all those people there is not criminal, is people that work, is people that
Right.
making a taxes in a couple the past
Right.
2 years ago. So it's people with permits to work, people with social security. So it's really I understand that
Right.
the concerns, but Venezuelan people have and a very good way to fix this problem.
Right. Adelis Ferro, I want to go back to what Congressman Diaz-Balart said about protecting non-criminal Venezuelans, TPS holders, and this is something Gustavo just referred to. I want to play this from a South Florida Venezuelan TPS recipient I spoke with named Daniela, who expressed how she felt about Trump's decision.
Devastated. I start crying because I didn't expect that. That was really, really bad. I'm in shock. You feel like a criminal. It's like if you're immigrant, you're a criminal in their eyes. Right now, I don't have a valid Venezuelan passport. And people that have their Venezuelan documents expired that are coming into Venezuela, they're getting in trouble. But Trump doesn't care what's going to happen to them.
So Ade, Daniela there was referring to one of Trump's big campaign topics last year, which was the Venezuelan criminal gang known as Tren de Aragua, some of whose members have committed crimes inside the U.S. All Venezuelans here seemed to get associated with Tren de Aragua in the minds of many Trump voters. So was that, in your opinion, the main reason Trump decided to take TPS away from Venezuelans like this in order to please his voter base?
Several things really quick, Tim. Mm-hmm. First of all, we were the target of the whole presidential campaign on Trump's side. The target. Every single time he was on a podium, he was talking about Venezuelans, criminals, animals. There were no distinctions.
Because of this Tren de Aragua factor.
Because of the Tren de Aragua fact. Mm-hmm. But this is another fact, and the data is on the ICE website, on the FBI website, and DOJ, Department of Justice website. There is no evidence whatsoever that not even one of those criminals have TPS. Mm-hmm. Not even one. So zero TPS beneficiaries from Venezuela has any ties, at least according to the official data, mm-hmm. with Tren de Aragua gang.
Okay.
So having said that, and no matter how many times they said that the situation in Venezuela has changed, no matter how many times they said it on a notice, then in the other hand, really quick, you have Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, today and yesterday on record, on video, saying that Venezuela is a threat for humanity. So okay. How can you reconcile these two statements.
Right. And I want to get to that. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Venezuelan expat leaders Adelis Ferro and Gustavo Garagori about the Trump administration's controversial decision to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gustavo Garagori, I want to get to that point that Adelis Ferro just made, that both Democrats and Republicans like yourselves here in the Venezuelan community agree that Venezuelan conditions back in Venezuela are not safe enough to send Venezuelan TPS holders back into that country. Do you feel that way as well, that the Trump administration is not right when it insists that it's okay for Venezuelans to go back to Venezuela? What do you think about that, Gustavo?
Well, I never heard that Trump say that Venezuela is now, you know, change everything. I didn't hear that. So
okay.
Venezuela is the same situation that happened 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1 years ago. The regime is there, is still there,
right.
And nothing changed in Venezuela. So I think so that this is the main reason that Congress, Mario Diaz-Balart, Carlos Jimenez, Maria Elvira Salazar supports and one solution to the Venezuelan people. So I think so, you know, that's very, I don't want to imagine what happened right now in the beauty salon or the nail salon, you know, everybody talking about this situation and the information and disinformation about all that happened right now.
Right.
So I believe that something happened, something coming to fix this problem in the forest,
Okay.
weeks.
So
So I
you
believe
feel there's a possibility then to get the Trump administration to change its mind about this?
of course, yes, of course, yes. I
Okay.
believe that Ms. Noem is wrong in different things. So, but I believe that we have a very good
Right.
Congress and
No.
people in administration as a Marcus Rubio that
Right.
I want to do something.
Noam, meaning Kristi Noem, President Trump's Homeland Security Secretary. Adelis Ferrero, as we mentioned, meanwhile, however, the group of Venezuelan TPS holders that Trump is targeting for now, anyway, are the more than 300,000 who arrived here in 2023 or before. Their TPS benefit will end in April, and then they face deportation. But there is another block, Ade, of Venezuelan TPS recipients, between 200,000 and 300,000 of them, who received TPS from President Biden back in 2021. Their current TPS benefit will be up for 18-month extension in September. Do you fear, Ade, that that group of Venezuelans will lose TPS as well?
Absolutely. And that's what we will see them in court. We will see that by the Trump administration in court. We are ready. And very soon, you guys from the media will be hearing from us because after the yesterday, Secretary Noem was answering a post of an interview of Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz at criticizing President Trump's decision about Venezuelan TPS. And then Kristi Noem, Secretary Noem, just mentioned that post on X. And it was, I cannot even repeat the words that she said about the Venezuelan community. So when you read things like that, there is no doubt on my mind that September, the TPS, the 2021 TPS, is going to be
Okay.
eliminated too.
And as you said
So,
in your press conference this week in Doral, you do expect a lot of legal tools being used between now and then to block this order. Is that
every single legal tool that we can use under the law is going to be used.
Okay. Gustavo Gorgori, I know you have worked in the past with immigrants and refugees. So if I'm a Venezuelan TPS holder right now, what should I be doing to prepare for what might be coming? How, for example, is the community in Doral, there where you live, the largest Venezuelan enclave in the U.S., how is it responding to the situation now?
I suggest them, have everything that they that all the documents that they have to prove that they be here in illegal situations, and then looking for helps in the with the lawyers, with the any other groups that try to help in this type of case. And actually, I'm gonna create a letter to send all my friends to send the different Congress and Senator to support the Dignity Act that a Congress Maria Elvira Salazar proposed in Congress right now. So I probably this isn't an a very good way to fix these things. So she need around 218 votes to support that law.
Adelis Ferro, in about the 20 seconds we have left, the same question to you. How do you feel Venezuelans should be preparing those with TPS, how they should be preparing for what might be coming?
Several things. Trying to talk to a lawyer to find some other immigration benefits for the ones that don't have another immigration benefits that can secure the status in the country at least temporarily. And the second thing is get informed, follow Venezuelan American Caucus in our all social media accounts. We are informing you every single day.
Okay.
And the third thing is know your rights. That's the
Okay.
most important things.
Well, we'll have to leave it there with that very important point. Adelis Ferro is co-founder and executive director of the Venezuelan American Caucus. Gustavo Garagori is president of the Venezuelan American Republican Club of Miami-Dade. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, team.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Still to come, could some of Miami-Dade's prominent black neighborhoods become this the county's newest city? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. You may remember a couple years ago, the city of Hialeah considered annexing the historically black neighborhood of Brownsville. Hialeah eventually backed off the idea, in no small part because Brownsville residents themselves opposed it. And they rejected it, in no small part, because Brownsville is an especially important seat of Miami's black history. Back when the city was still segregated, Brownsville hosted black icons like Martin Luther King Jr. and Muhammad Ali. But the Hialeah annexation bid made community leaders in Brownsville and other historically black neighborhoods in that vicinity of Miami-Dade ask how to avoid future attempts by other cities in the county. And the answer may be, become our own city. Last month, the Miami-Dade County Commission voted to study the feasibility of that idea, and the result could see Brownsville, as well as the Gladeview, Twin Lakes North Shore Gardens, and Gratney neighborhoods incorporated into one town. What do you think of the idea and what it could mean for South Florida's black community? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to explore this potential new city is the Brownsville Civic Association's president, Kenneth Kilpatrick. Kenneth, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
Before we look at the feasibility study that's now underway, I first want to remind our listeners why historically black communities like Brownsville are so important to the culture of Miami. Remind us of the key role Brownsville played here during segregation and the civil rights movement, for example.
So the Brownsville community is home to a few very important and iconic venues. One of them is the historic Hampton House. And the Hampton House was the place where, you know, when many of the black performers would go over to Miami Beach and perform, they couldn't stay there. Yeah. So they had to come back to the community where they would perform in our community, and they would also be able to live. You know, they'd also be able to stay. So historic Hampton House is one of those places. Another place in Brownsville is the Georgette Tea Room. Georgette Tea Room is actually considered one of the last standing tea rooms remaining in the southeastern United States.
Right. So is it fair to say then that this was the big reason why Brownsville residents largely rejected Hialeah's proposal to annex the neighborhood, a fear that being absorbed into another city like that might dilute the historical and cultural character of the community?
Yeah, I mean, in particular, if it's, I'm sorry, the city of Hialeah, we just didn't feel that they had a history of being able to cultivate, you know, African-American history and peoples and culture.
What were some of the other big reasons, though, that residents in Brownsville opposed being absorbed into Hialeah?
You know, it wasn't just Hialeah. You know, it's just a concept of being annexed, period.
Mm-hmm.
That was the true motivator. If you look at what happens when communities are usually annexed, there's usually, you know, maybe you might get one seat on the dais.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you incorporate, you know, as an alternative, all the seats on that dais belong to your neighborhoods.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's going to be an annexation versus incorporation question, I think the obvious preference would be to incorporate, and as opposed to being annexed, and then that representation on the dais becomes trivial.
But there were also some financial considerations that I want to get to a little later concerning, you know, how are people in Brownsville, how are they were going to maybe see their tax situation change. Their tax rates go up because of new services being provided by annexation as well. There were some more practical issues involved as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And those considerations are still on the table. It's one of the main things that we are looking at in terms of the studies that right. are going to be launched soon.
So as I mentioned, in the aftermath of Hialeah's failed bid to annex Brownsville, the community, as well as other historically black neighborhoods in that part of Miami-Dade County, decided to look at ways to avoid that kind of thing in the future. Tell us about the other three communities here that we're talking about, like Gladeview, and where they sit geographically in relation to Brownsville, and how you got together to petition the Miami-Dade County Commission to hear your idea about possibly creating a whole new city. I know County Commissioner Marlene Bastien played a role in this, right?
That's correct. You know, first, I'm so grateful to Commissioner Bastien for her support, because if you don't have that, there's no real reason to move forward trying to get anything enacted in studies. It's all for naught if you don't have that support.
Right.
But to your earlier point about the neighborhood associations, I'm so proud of the way that they have responded. Just north of Brownsville is a community called Gladeview.
Gladeview. Mm-hmm.
And Gladeview and Brownsville together is what the unincorporated portions of Model City make up today.
Okay.
So just north of 79th Street, you get into the North Shore communities, and there are two community associations. There's the North Shore Community Association and the North Shore, the Twin Lakes North Shore Gardens Association. And just a little north from there is the Gratney. Neighborhood Association.
So this is all contiguous. Then.
It's all contiguous. That's correct.
Right.
And then there's another association. I'm sorry. That's the Little River Farms Association. That's also going to be participating. We're so glad that they're going to be a part of it.
So we've got a total of five then communities that are really coming together.
Yeah, it's five or six. Yeah.
Now, we discussed earlier why Brownsville residents largely opposed Hialeah's bid to annex their community a couple years ago. But do you sense that there's more support among residents both in Brownsville and the other communities like Gladeview that we've just mentioned? Is there support among those residents to incorporate themselves as a city? Have you had any petition signings, for example, that show evidence that, yes, that this is an idea that has broad support?
What we did is we went directly to the homeowners associations.
Okay.
And those associations meet every month, and the folks come out of the neighborhood every month. So we thought that would be a very good strategic step one.
Okay.
If the neighborhood associations aren't on board, then, you know, it's all for naught.
And we say when we say they're on board to at least study the feasibility.
That's right.
All right. And so you do feel then that there's at least a groundswell of support for that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And it really doesn't go much further than that at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a great concern about what's going to happen to the taxes. Everybody's concerned about the cost.
Yeah, and I want to get to that, as I said. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Brownsville Civic Association President Kenneth Kilpatrick about the possibility of historically black neighborhoods like Miami-Dade County's Brownsville joining together to create a new city here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Kenneth, what then happens now? What will be the deciding factors in determining whether this idea of forming a new incorporated city out of these several neighborhoods happens?
So, if there is enough of a groundswell in terms of that cost, if there is, you know, if there's evidence that says that, you know, your taxes may go up, of course they're going to go up a little bit to pay for municipal services,
sure,
but that cost is not going to price out individuals who may be on fixed incomes, seniors on fixed incomes, low to middle class working families. Mm-hmm. Who may not be able to absorb that, who may have just purchased a house. And as we know, just the market to buy a house is through the roof now.
Yeah.
So those are going to be it's really a financial feasibility study to see if we can handle it.
Right.
Right.
What's your best guess about that? I mean, because as I said, one of the reasons Brownsville residents rejected Hialeah's annexation bid was less about culture and more about pocketbooks. In many ways, there was a fear that the enhanced public services Hialeah was promising could also result in things like higher taxes, as you just mentioned. That balancing act is obviously going to play out now as Brownsville and the other communities decide whether to form their own city. So what do you think is the best way to show people that their taxes will not go up inordinately, let's say, if they were to incorporate into a new city? What sort of measures need to be taken to blunt that?
Well, first things first, we don't want to tell people that their taxes aren't going to go up.
Right.
So if you want a city,
straightforward,
you know, here is the invoice, and we're hoping that that invoice is not, to your point, exorbitant.
Right.
Right. So we think that the area, the size of the area that we're looking at, mm-hmm. it goes from 135th Street down to 54th Street. Mm-hmm. And then on the west border is the city of Hialeah for all of it. And then on the east, there are three cities. There's Miami Shores, there's North Miami, and the city of Miami. Mm-hmm. So the size of the area, I think, is going to help to mitigate what that price tag may be. And we're actually looking to expand that area to take in all of unincorporated Brownsville,
right.
which is not in the study area now. So we want to, if we can get all of Brownsville in the study area, mm-hmm. we think that that will bring the overall number down.
Right. So you feel that the residential tax base is large enough to make the ratio between services and tax base.
That's correct.
Jive enough so that people's taxes won't. But just as important, you know, in terms of helping to keep people's taxes from becoming exorbitant, as you say, if there's incorporation, how would this new city's, what would its main revenue driver be? What would the economic tax base of the city look like aside from residential tax base in terms right. of businesses?
So that's part of what the studies will help bring out. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that to the west of the study area, the western edge of it, there is a couple miles. There's miles and miles of industrial that we could look at. And then there are some industrial parks, and there are some special designations in terms of foreign trade zones that are...
Yeah.
Those designations are within the area, so there's some opportunities that we can look at.
So that's interesting. You feel that maybe incorporation could help revive or invigorate what, for the moment, looks like kind of a dormant industrial
that's
base.
Correct.
And incorporation could maybe trigger that.
That's
more.
Correct.
That's a very important point. On the flip side, though, is the status quo sustainable? If Brownsville and these other communities don't form their own incorporated entity, is there a fear that these neighborhoods could become static and face the possibility of not annexation, but other concerns that we so often face today because of the high cost of living here, like gentrification? I'm asking, do communities like Brownsville find themselves caught right now between the Scylla of incorporation and the Charybdis of isolation?
Yeah, and I think there's a real fear that annexation is more of an inevitability,
right.
if we don't do something for ourselves.
Yeah, no, yeah. that's particularly the gentrification issue. I wanted to, if incorporation doesn't happen, does that make neighborhoods like Brownsville more of a target for gentrification? Because, as we just pointed out, without the sort of industrial invigoration of an area like that, people might be more willing to leave.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. Gentrification in areas like Brownsville and neighboring communities is well underway, unfortunately.
Okay.
And so I think that incorporation, if it's feasible, if we can get enough of a coalition of communities to come together, mm-hmm. would probably be what I would call the Hail Mary to save our neighborhoods.
Well, Kenneth, in the 30 seconds we have left, what's your best guess then as to what will ultimately occur at the end of this feasibility study process? Do you see a 35th incorporated city in Miami-Dade resulting from this?
Well, we certainly hope so, but we're allowing the numbers, the feasibilities to kind of stand in front of us. We don't want to fight the numbers, and so we're really hopeful that we have a large enough area and enough of a support base, mm-hmm. to be able to move forward if the numbers pan out.
And if it does happen, have any names for the new city been proposed yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, we'll wait for that then. Kenneth Kilpatrick is president of the Brownsville Civic Association. Kenneth, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, a new WLRN documentary shows us the awful cost Haiti paid when it lost the Creole pig. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The Creole pig means more than food in Haiti. The Creole cochon is one of the country's important historical icons. Its sacrifice was a central part of the spiritual ceremony that started the Haitian Revolution in 1791. After Haiti won its independence, the Creole pig became the linchpin not just of Haitian agriculture, but of the autonomy, if not the power, of Haitian rural society. But in the 20th century, Haiti's corrupt elites, with a big assist from the United States, conspired to eradicate the Creole pig, and in the process, they brought the collapse of the Haitian countryside and the country itself in many ways that we're seeing today. That compelling link between the demise of the Creole pig and the crisis of Haiti is the subject of a new documentary produced by WLRN called The Creole Pig, Haiti's Great Loss, which will air on WLRN-TV next Thursday, February 13th at 9 p.m. Are you familiar with the history of the Creole pig in Haiti? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is the director and co-producer of the Creole Pig documentary, Haitian-American Miami filmmaker Dudley Alexis. Dudley, thank you for coming and congratulations on this captivating and important documentary.
Thank you for having me.
The film starts with that fascinating piece of Haitian history I mentioned at the outset, what's known as the Bois Caiman ceremony that sparked the Haitian slave revolt of the 1790s and the revolution that led to Haitian independence in 1804. Tell us, Dudley, why the Creole pig played an important, if not sacred, part in that drama.
Well, the thing is, the Creole pig was central to the Haitian, central to the ceremony of Bois Caiman, and it became not only a religious symbol in voodoo, but also a key cultural aspect for Haitian. And also, after the Haitian Revolution, we had the emergence of the Lakou, and then the Creole pig became central to the Lakou, and allow Haitians to become, to have their own autonomy, to not really dependent on the government or the state, to be pretty much allow them that freedom in a society.
Remind us, I want to make sure people understand what the Lakou was. I mean, you had this plantation system run by the French in colonial Haiti, or what was then known as Saint-Domingue. And then after independence, Haitians went into that plantation system, tore it up, and created the Lakou system, which is essentially, how did it work?
Well, the Lakou system was, like you said, after the Haitian Revolution, the formerly enslaved people just, took those plantations, split it, distributed them among themselves, and created the Lakou system.
Right.
And the Lakou system did not have a overseer or anything like that. It was it was run by families, and it was really egalitarian. And usually on a Lakou, you have 5, 6, 7 houses, and they're in charge pretty much of the land or the fields around them, and they're produced for themselves.
It was sort of a collective,
yes,
type of system. And we should point out that Lakou in Creole means home.
Home. It means backyard. And the Lakou is still in many ways, is still there in Haiti. It's still vibrant in Haiti, and it's still central and struggling. I'm not going to say struggling to survive, but it's there. Right. In Haitian society.
Why did the Creole pig then go on to play such a central economic role in that system?
Well, what's important to understand about pig in Haiti, it's everything the farmer produce, Anything that is the surplus, they feed to the pig. Anything that is
that's the supposed to be will eat just about anything.
Anything,
right?
Anything that is waste, and because of that, the pig allowed them to anything that that they have to be transformed into capital.
Right.
They can just grab that, take it to the market, and sell it.
Right.
And because of that, the pig, that access to capital, that's what the pig provided them.
But the pig was also very important in helping farmers grow things in the way that when they started rutting through the fields, they were essentially plowing it for them.
That's the thing. The pig has such an interesting relationship with land and allow farmers, it make it much easier for farmers to grow. And that's the difference between between having cows and or goats that you need big grazing area for. Pigs, you do not need that. You just need a little small area, and you grow enough food. You can feed the pigs and make the pig have a much higher yield than
right. Because all this Creole pig was very prolific. I mean, he could reproduce exponentially, really, right?
Yes, and the farmer did not need much to actually raise a pig. They did not invest at all to raise a pig. Right. That's the most interesting part.
So this pig was an extraordinarily important economic asset and an extraordinarily important social asset because it helped raise the socioeconomic living standard of rural Haitians in when the Republic started.
Yes, yes. And one thing I found out during this project is farmers will say, oh, the way we used to do it, we raise a few chicken, and the chicken allow us to buy the pigs, and the pigs allow us to buy probably a few cows, and the cows allow us to buy land, and they use it as a way to climb up, to raise, and to get more land to build their own wealth.
But that's the thing. This pig helped rural Haitians send their kids to school, pay for weddings. A lot of things that a lot of peasants around the world maybe didn't even have at that time, but thanks to this pig, it sort of helped social mobility in Haiti, no?
That's the thing. It helped the social mobility, and also because Haitian farmer produce almost everything that they want to eat, they need for themselves. The pig only allowed them. That's why, you know, for major event, when they need capital, that's why the pig was so essential. So when they're having that wedding, like you said, and they sell the pig, the funeral, they sell the pig, a big party, and the pig was there.
But then, as I mentioned, in the 20th century, Haiti's urban elites start this effort to undermine the Lacou system, no?
The Lacou system, as always, is not just in the 19th century or...
I'm talking about the 20th century.
20th century. It's since the revolution. It's been the struggle of back and forth between the Lacou and the elite of Haiti, because the Lacou is so independent from the states, and you can, for you to control Haiti, you need to control the Lacou, and it become extremely difficult.
So the elites were very jealous, really, of the Lacou, because, is a way of putting it, no?
Because at the end of the Haitian Revolution, you end up having, and that's one of the things that's extremely unique to Haiti, is most of the land are not controlled by the elites. And in Haiti, most of the land and the highest producing lands are controlled by farmers.
But then comes the Duvalier dictatorship in 1957. Its first ruler, Papa Doc Duvalier, seems to understand the importance of the Creole pig to the Haitian population. But his son, Baby Doc Duvalier, then falls under the sway of those elites in the 1970s who want to do away or at least undermine the Lacou system for their benefit and the Creole pig. And they're helped by a swine sickness that begins sweeping the world at that time, right? Tell us about that.
Well, the difference between the two Duvaliers, that's one of the things doing this project, understanding how the son and the father, how they were different from each other. The son has a really connection with the rural side, and the father had a really good connection with the rural side, but the son did not.
Exactly.
And when the son came to power, that connection that wasn't there allow him to really not to understand how to deal with Haitian farmers.
And we'll get to the consequence of that right now. Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami filmmaker Dudley Alexis about the fascinating new WLRN documentary, The Creole Pig, Haiti's Great Loss. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So I mentioned that sickness for pigs, the African swine flu. And the arrival of that plague, let's call it, for the Creole pig, means also the arrival of the U.S. What happened then?
Well, the one thing during this project, I found out how the African swine fever, ASF, was, you know, going throughout the world. And right around that, pig was becoming industrialized. Production was becoming extremely industrialized, and the pig industry here was in the U.S. had a fear of
being contaminated by the African swine fever from Haiti.
And it went to Europe, went through France and Spain, and from Spain it made it to Brazil, and went to the DR, and the DR made it to Haiti.
Dominican Republic being the DR.
Out of fear, the U.S. came in and actually pressured the Duvalier to eradicate the Creole pig.
Right, and so the USDA, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, comes in, this program to pay farmers to have their pigs slaughtered.
And the thing is, like, a lot of the farmers did not want to get their pigs slaughtered, and if you did not, and you there were retaliation, imprisonment, and people were getting beat up, every single thing, you know, all of that because of the Creole pig.
Right. And your documentary does an especially powerful job of recounting how the U.S. then sort of completes that process of the eradication of the Creole pig in the Haitian countryside. And the eradication of the Creole pig then results in the implosion, really, of Haitian agriculture, but also the eradication of a solid, effective system that we were talking about that sustained rural Haitians economically, but also gave them a measure of dignity socially and politically. I want to play here a really salient point that Haitian American cultural researcher Cecile Asselien makes in your film.
We have to look at this whole issue from the perspective of power. In the case of the pig, by removing the pigs, they took away the power of so many, of thousands of families in Haiti. They took away their financial power. They took away the social power that came with it.
So as she says, Dudley, the pig wasn't just food. The pig was power. How then did the removal of that power from the life of the ordinary Haitian begin to result in the unraveling of Haitian society itself?
Well, the thing is, what's interesting about in Haiti, you have that disconnect between the countryside and the people that live in the city,
the
urban elite.
Centers, right.
And usually, if you don't bother the people outside, your government will run, as you know. So the fact that with Duvalier allowed that caused many movement to grow in Haiti, many movement that came from the rural side, right, and some of them that also end up being, like, you know, in some of the impoverished right, part of some of the cities.
The backlash helped get Duvalier thrown out of power, right?
Yeah, because the economy crashed. That was an actual crash of the Haitian economy.
Finally, Dudley, then, coming up to today, what do you hope viewers will take away from the documentary in terms of how the demise of the Creole pig has in many ways led to the economic, political, and above all, gang violence crisis Haiti is experiencing today? In just 20 seconds, please.
Well, what happened, it made agricultural not profitable anymore. So a lot of people end up in the urban cities.
Right.
And being in the cities, with the government not paying attention to what's happening in the cities and politically depoliticized the urban.
A lot of displacement.
Yeah.
Right.
So end up with what we have today.
Dudley Alexis is the director and co-producer of the new WLRN documentary, The Creole Pig, Haiti's Great Loss. It will air on WLRN-TV next Thursday, February 13th at 9 p.m. Dudley, many thanks and congratulations.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, a historic Steinway & Sons piano has returned to Vizcaya Museum and Gardens in Miami after more than a century. South Florida Roundup producer Jimena Romero recently visited it.
The 1916 piano was documented in archival photographs, but the instrument was removed from the villa sometime in the late 1920s. Elena Gomez is the museum's curator. She says a family who asked to remain anonymous acquired it in the 1980s and passed it down through several generations.
It really is a rare opportunity to reacquire such a significant object that reflects the musical spirit of Vizcaya.
Vizcaya's patron, James Deering, commissioned the instrument to match an antique harpsichord that he purchased in 1914. The music you're listening to features artist Robert Heath and was recorded on the Vizcaya harpsichord. The piano also has Deering's initial on its lead.
You can see the direct similarities with its carvings around the frame with floral and coral motifs.
While the piano is over 100 years old, the instrument is still in playable condition. You can't hear it yet. The museum is hoping to showcase its sound in the near future. I'm Jimena Romero in Miami.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.